We'll finish that song later, but for now, we got Connection. We have George Marie on the line. It's my fault, actually. I am Filter's sole performer, interviewer, producer, and phone call operator. So sometimes things get a little wild. Sounds like things are getting wild over there too, George. You can always you can always cancel on me on the air too. That works for me.
No, but I was just running. I just picked up my son, and from outdoor school at Cedar Root.
Oh, nice.
And there was like a dog barking, like trying to run inside and get him settled. But I'm ready.
Okay, cool.
I mean,
how old is he?
We only just kind of chit chat.
Yeah.
In the beginning, anyway. So
it's true. We have to get it's the like. I'm going to play a Nina Simone song later today, but there's this great movie that actually directed by John Malkovich called The Dancer Upstairs. And it has this just amazing, you know, opening sequence where these people are driving in a car, very mysterious reasons, in South America. And they're listening to this Nina Simone song, her version of Where Does the Time Go? And she spends in that live song, she spends about 5 minutes talking before she actually starts singing. And, it's just the one person is saying, why does she talk so much? And somebody just says she's preparing to sing. And that's what we're doing. That's my long roundabout anecdote about what we do. We chit chat. So we're just, you know, it's more like you getting ready to sing, because I feel like you're our star here, but, don't let me blow too much smoke up there, but you know,
I feel like it's a conversation, and that feels really I definitely don't feel like the star. I will say that I had an experience where I did theater as a college student, and one time, and I was, you know, legitimately in a way the star, quote unquote, like I had the main role.
Yeah.
And so one of my colleagues, who, you know, wasn't being cruel. I just want to say this. He wasn't being cruel, but he taught me a very valuable lesson, because he said, George, when you are on stage, who's the most important person? And I thought about it, and I said, well, me. And I, because I had all the lines, right? And I was, that's what I was thinking in my head. And he said, no, actually, it's everybody else. Because if they don't remember their lines, or somebody forgets to cue you with the light, or if the sound isn't working, you can't do your job.
That's true.
And I feel like when we, you know, I feel like one of the reasons why I like coming on the radio and talking with you, Paul, is that it's a casual conversation. Neither one of us are experts. We're not meant to be kind of masters of whatever it is we're talking about. We're just having a conversation about ideas. And I'm hoping that that's just inviting everybody, whoever they are, whatever their background, whatever their job, whatever their level of education, to just start having these conversations too, and feel like that's something that they can do, that they're not being shut out of the conversation.
I love that.
You know?
I love that. And, right. You know, I'm so excited for the future, too, as we progress. There's great COVID news this week, obviously, with Pfizer's vaccine looking like it's 90% effective, maybe more than 90% effective, that we could get to a point in the next year where we actually are able to have more than one person in the studio and have these conversations, just real organic conversations on the air, and really include other people in it as well.
Right.
So I'm excited for the future of this ongoing conversation. And I love the way you put it about just sort of making people feel like it's okay. It's good to have these conversations. You know, I always called myself a generalist, and I wonder sometimes that's like, for some people, that's an insult. Cause you're like, you know, what is the phrase? Master of none, like,
Jack of all trades, master of none.
That's right. That's right. And that is me. That is me in my life, you know, like, how it's been. And I've always really respected, experts and people who know what they're doing in all these different fields, but I've never been an expert. I could have never said that I'm an expert. in pretty much anything. And I'm happy about that because I can just spread myself everywhere.
And I feel like it's so important to acknowledge that a lot of the knowledge that we have is because people were willing to spend their lives trying to answer one or two probably pretty minute and small questions, or maybe a lot of really big questions, sometimes two. But that it's like, I think it's a hard thing because right now we're at a time where experts and any kind of expert opinion is being assailed, mm-hmm. right? And I don't want to do that. So I feel like I'm tiptoeing there because it is important when people have spent their lives studying medicine, for example, that we look at the information that they're giving us and we're able to critically examine it, which is also including, like, who is this person that I'm listening to? Are they credible? Do they have an expertise and a background in what it is they're trying to tell me? But at the same time that we use our own critical agency to evaluate that information. I'm always feel like I'm teetering on the balancing between that. And then also this really important opening of a question and being and opening ourselves up to doubt and mm-hmm. opening ourselves up to being really, to not just trusting what we're being told. Like Pfizer's telling us this vaccine is 90% effective. And I want to believe that, and I really hope that that is true, and I'm hoping there's more and more and more evidence that comes forward to support that. And it's also okay to be a lover of science and also be like, you know, I just want to make sure that this evidence, that there's evidence here, you know, and that I'm getting as much information as I can about whatever it is, whatever question I have. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And trusting where information comes from, that's the big, I mean, that's something we've talked about several times is how can we trust these sources? And, you know, what one thing I like about science, even though I don't claim to understand a lot about it, is that there are rigorous, methodical, you know, systems that, you know, and I think we've even spoken about how some of those are systemically racist and sexist and broken. But, you know, so not that they're without their problems, but and sometimes they give us false information, like that strange situation with gluten allergies. But, you know, I guess I try to we have to put some faith in the interpreters of things we don't understand. With science, I'm just so much more ready to give myself over to interpretations of people who are scientists or who understand science. I'm ready to put myself in their hands constantly. And, you know, more so than I think I was in my 20s, where I felt like science maybe is like a form of religion. I remember I used to say that and people would be like, older, smarter people would be like, no, don't you dare compare science to religion. And now I see where they're coming from, you know, because it's not something that's based on faith. It's something that's based on systems, you know, systems of discovery. But yeah.
There's still faith in those systems. There is still, because I do think it's legitimate to say that there's still faith in those systems, just like we have faith in language. Like when you and I say something, we have faith we believe when we nod our heads and be like, yeah, I totally get where you're coming from. Yeah, you know, there's faith there. There's belief there because ultimately words are arbitrary. They're not inherently linked to their meanings, which is one of the reasons why the meaning of the meanings of words change over time.
Yeah.
And that exists in science too, because science is put into language. And even data, you know, we've talked about that before, that like you can get a whole set of numbers, right, data numbers, and everybody can agree on what those numbers are and disagree on what those numbers mean. Mm. And so there are always gaps. There's always openings. There's always mechanisms for doubt. But I think that's the beauty of science, is that science is not, the method itself is not meant to prove anything. You're actually going through a system of disproving. So you're attempting to disprove something. And when you can't disprove it, it becomes a law, right? Mm. So you're never like saying, I have this observation and I'm going to prove that it's true. You say, I have an observation. Now I'm going to put it into a hypothesis and I'm going to try to disprove that hypothesis is true. I'm going to do everything that I can to make this non-repeatable. Mm. If you do that and you do it with control groups and you do it carefully and methodically and you gather that data and you honestly, you know, look at the data, and if you can't prove disprove the hypothesis that you've put forth, well, then that's when, you get a bunch of your peers involved and then they start trying to replicate your results. Ultimately trying to undermine your results. Mm. I mean, that's the beauty of it, right?
Yeah.
Is it's got constant scrutiny. So to me, and maybe I'm just too much of an optimist, I never think that the scrutiny of science, the method of science itself, is in itself a negative thing. The scrutiny of language is never in itself a negative thing. The scrutiny of truth is never in itself a negative thing. It can cause political challenges. Mm. It can cause existential challenges. But ultimately, I think over the course of humanity, over the course of time, right, which is not just our lives, but multiple lives and generations and centuries and millennia, it works in our favor.
Mm. Yeah, I can't.
That makes sense.
Yeah, right? No, it makes perfect
sometimes
sense.
Sometimes I feel like I'm babbling.
Well, it kind of has, I want you to be right. And I want to live in a world where it's about disproving things first before you just sort of accept them. But you know, it's the bifurcation that's happening right now between, and I don't know if it's as simple as like an individual divide, but we've talked about that a lot before. Not that we mm-hmm. shouldn't talk about it again, but I'm looking forward to the ever expanding and continuing conversation that we'll be having. And I want to talk about the Grotesque Mother, but first I want to play the song you brought, which is the end of everything, right? Noah Cyrus.
Yeah.
Were you going to connect it to our next topic, or do you want to introduce it for our listeners, or just let them feel the end of everything as we're all kind of secretly feeling right now?
I think it doesn't connect with our topic. It was just a song that I heard that, I just had my birthday and feeling the weight of time as I move through this life. And I think time and the beauty of transience in every way, in our personal lives and in the life of ideals and in science and in narrative storytelling and in words and what they mean, I guess that will connect with the topic of the Grotesque Mother. But, these things are impermanent and there are ends.
Yeah.
There are ends. We can always expect an end. I mean, one thing is certain. If you're alive, you're going to die. Everything that's living dies and changes. And it changes throughout its lifetime. You know, our cells are constantly living and dying. Our thoughts are constantly living and dying. You know, this is the it sounds kind of woo-woo, but it's not. It's a scientific reality.
Well, one thing that's come to an end, though, is your birthday, but we can say a belated happy birthday, George Marie. Sorry, I had to give you some air horn.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
You got it. Anytime. Let's listen to the song, and then let's go deep. Well, we'll always go deep. We'll go surface one of these days. We'll have a really surface level. I'll bring you on the pizza episode. That'll be, and we'll just, yeah.
Oh, my God, I was a pizza cook.
Were you really? Okay.
Yes, I was. Okay. So I'm down for the pizza conversation.
Oh, my God, I can't wait. Sure. Okay, let's listen to this Noah Cyrus song, The End of Everything, and then we'll be back with George Marie in a second. Well, that song almost had me crying. So good. It's so good. It's, oh, God. I think of this, you know, I don't really like him anymore, but this rapper, Slug, his group Atmosphere, he had this line when I remember hearing it when I was super scared to die, spent so much of my 20s afraid of death, just like everything afraid of death, crippling. And I remember he said something like, I would hate to run a marathon that didn't have an end. I was like, well, yeah, like, but you know, seeing the beauty in the end, seeing, you know, some sort of love and, I mean, appreciation of the finality of life, isn't that, it's one of the most difficult things that we can do. And, you know, I feel like I'm going to spend the rest of my life doing it, even though I'm better now, but it's just it's a lifetime work.
I can relate to that because my brother, my father adopted his two stepchildren. And we really, even though I only got to see them holidays and during the summer vacation, I really feel very much that they are my, you know, they're my family just as much as my other siblings are. And so my brother and I were both 19 when he was killed in a hunting accident. Mm. And it was very, very hard, you know. In fact, he was missing for a few months, and I found out that he was missing because it was on the news. And I heard his name and I thought, oh, that's weird. That's my brother's name. Mm. And then, so I was like looking at the news, and then all of a sudden his picture came up and I was like, wait a second. So my family hadn't told us because they were sure they were going to find him. Mm. And it was really heart wrenching. The search parties were released. You know, they didn't find him. And then 2 weeks after that, some hikers found him because an animal had scavenged his body and had pulled it up from where it had fallen.
Wow.
And he had been hunting by himself and just tripped. He tripped. And fell. And, you know, it was an accident, a very tragic, sad accident. He had a pregnant wife and a young child. Mm. And his funeral was on one day before my birthday, my 20th birthday. So I made it to 20 and my brother did not. And I would wake up in the night with this thought, Paul, this single thought, this line, this like line of narrative, right? The story. And it would wake me up and I would look around the room and I thought, oh, this is just what it is. This is life right here. You know, there's nothing, all my dreams, all my hopes, all my aspirations, all my plans, they're distilled in this exact moment. Mm. And that's all we have. Mm. That's all we have. And so I really get that. I get that kind of wrestling, that existential wrestling. And, you know, what's interesting about the ideas of narrative, you know, kind of the theories behind narrative theory is that, like for Freud and Jung, and I don't really know Jung that well, but for Freud, for sure, everything, story itself, narrative story itself, comes from kind of a retrospective look at the fact that we're going to die and we're in denial about that. So we have this kind of end point for all of our lives, and we're just, we are in every moment of our lives in complete disavowal of that end point. Because it's, I think Buddhists talk about it as like living as though you're already dead. It's very difficult to live that way, to really be present, to really to not grapple with the fact that death can come for us at any time. And one of the consequences of that disavowal of that knowledge, so disavowal meaning I know very well, but I'm going to kind of subconsciously subvert that knowledge, and I'm going to turn it into other things. I'm going to turn it into all these anxieties. I'm going to turn it into neuroses. I'm going to turn it into pathologies. I'm going to turn it into my creative drive. I'm going to turn it into the death drive, or whatever, if you want to go a Freudian route with it. But I feel like that space, that grappling space, is it really is what it means to be alive. There's a lot of meaning in what it means to be alive and the fact that we're going to die. And that change that we are confronting is something we're always resisting, which is the whole idea behind the grotesque mother. I don't know if you want me to just keep babbling.
I mean, I'm just thinking while you're talking, I'm thinking about a couple things. First, as a side note, I have a friend, Justin, who's a Jungian scholar. So we should at some point just like, we could involve him we could learn about Jung from him. Because I don't actually know that much either, you know, the collective unconscious or what if it's I can't remember. We can bring Justin along maybe at some point.
I'm really fascinated. I want to learn more about Jung. Sure.
Let's learn more on the air and expose our listeners to our didactic boring conversation. It's not boring. I just say that's my own self-effacing. But then I was also thinking about that, you know, because you're so right. Living in the moment versus trying to hang on, you know, to the past or fix the past or control and, you know, mediate the future, you know, which is really, it's the future where we really try and fix, you know, death, you know, keep ourselves alive in those, you know, sort of delusional desires, you know, that are often born out of hurt, things that were done to us or things that we might have done to ourselves too, that make us need to exercise more control beyond what is reasonable or realistic, and control that actually takes away from your ability to live in the moment. And I don't always live in the moment, obviously, but I've learned to find the moment, and I really learned through lots of magic mushrooms was the key for me to help ground me in the moment, and to see life, you know, to see that time in some ways doesn't exist, that it is just sort of the illusion that our brains for some reason, you know, need to survive, but that it's all, you know, all these things happen at once in some regards. And I don't understand the science, obviously, generalism here, you know, but I do believe that there's some evidence and research to show that our brains are really conditioned to follow linear time. And that, you know, and maybe in some ways is also responsible for these fears, these crippling anxieties about our lives that we have at the end of the day, almost no control over.
Yeah, I feel like, one of the things that I should just admit to you all on the air is that I've studied a lot of Freud, and Freud gets a very bad rap because he's oftentimes, I think, pretty unfairly put through a modern lens. And And he's put through that lens rightfully, because his ideas should be put through that lens now. But he himself as a person, right, is not to blame for patriarchy. He's not to blame for even some of the ideas that he had. He was really trying to observe the world. And one of the consequences of him observing the world was to say stories really make human beings human. Mm. Stories are so much a part of who we are. Mm. And so he was using stories as a way to explore human psychology, including his own pathologies. I think it's really important to note that Freud was one of the first, in fact, I'm pretty sure he was the first doctor, and then later he joined with another doctor and they did a paper together. But his paper originally was put out, and I can't remember the exact date, it was late 1800s sometime in the 1800s, where he put out a paper about male hysteria, and he was ridiculed relentlessly about it, because until then, hysteria was seen as only a female disease, and it was connected with how women's brains would be pathologized because their uterus was floating wantonly around their bodies.
Oh my God.
Which is, you know, I mean, now we can laugh at that and think that that's so stupid. But Freud really, he rejected that. He rejected those kinds of claims. He believed that if men and women were different, that it wasn't something essential in the body that made them different. That if they were taking on different societal roles, if they were taking on different characteristics that had nothing to do with just bodies, that if they were more passive, or if, you know, if women were more passive and men were more aggressive, it had nothing to do with just pure bodily function. It had to do with our cultures and our societies and the stories that we were telling ourselves at the moments that we were born, as we develop our what we now call the ego. But that is that's a Freudian concept, right? Mm. The ego, this idea that we have a self. And what he really wanted to do was call into question this idea of a stable self entity that is essential, that is inherent in form. And he wanted to, what his observation was that our mothers and our fathers play a crucial role in us determining that function, and that it's also cultural, right? So it's universal, but it's also cultural. And so there are some different concepts about what it means to be a woman and what it means to be a man that people do adopt in their cultures. And that gets to the grotesque mother, because the grotesque mother is kind of, I'm making it up totally. I mean, maybe somebody else has said this, but it's about us. It's never about our mothers. It's never about some like celebrity figure out there. I jokingly said J.K. Rowling, just because she has this kind of anti-trans bent that she's working on right now. Which is her own thing that she's got to work through. And unfortunately, it has a lot of other, because she's a public figure now, a lot of people are kind of glomming on to these ideas, which is pretty sad. But you know, the grotesque mother is just this idea that our mothers are, we're born onto their care, and they keep us safe, and they make us feel, you know, if they're good moms, quote unquote, that the whole idea culturally is that they make us feel safe, and they make us feel like danger isn't going to come, right? Mm. And when you're a mother yourself, that's what you feel like your job is. Like, my job is to keep my children safe until they are adult enough to enter into the world on their own, right?
Yeah.
That desire to want to kind of we go back into that, like to regress into that space where we have these very stable ideas about the world, where everything has its place and everything's in its place. And there's these very clear lines between things, and there's no gray area. Mm. Or if there is a gray area, that it's, that we're going to have some kind of soothing authoritative entity come in and let us know that it's all okay. That is a deeply problematic place to be psychologically, because it's not real.
Hmm.
That's not true. So, you know, I kind of like flippantly, said that about the grotesque mother, but really the concept that I'm encouraging us to explore is just the idea that we as living beings in the world, we're not things.
Hmm.
Jean-Paul Sartre has a very famous book called Being and Nothingness.
Hmm.
He's a French existentialist, a philosopher. And being and nothingness means in our being, we are not things. No thingness. We are not things.
Mm.
And because we're not things, we do not have static identities. We do not have stable identities. And that means that in a lot of ways, we encapsulate liminal spaces. And I would argue that for J.K. Rowling and for others and for, essentialists, that when they are trying to argue that there are just these shelf-stable identities that we can create and these very clear lines between what it means to be a woman and what it means to be a man and any of that, that is a desire for control, that is a desire to make the liminal, gray, terrifying realities of our lives go away, so we don't have to grapple with them.
Mm.
And it also is, and I think in J.K. Rowling's case, she talks about sexual assault, and when you have experienced the trauma of a physical assault, and I have, the desire to create boundaries and create control is very strong.
Mm.
And it can trap us into thinking about things in ways that are not only damaging to ourselves, they feel more comfortable, they're more comforting, but they can be really damaging to other people, which is what I think J.K. Rowling is doing personally. I don't want to psychoanalyze her or pathologize her. I'm definitely not trying to demonize her. I understand the struggle that we all have as human beings, but I also think that argument that she is making, and for anybody who doesn't know, she's arguing that trans people don't exist, basically. They don't exist. You're either a man or you're a woman. You can't be both or either. If you're born one way, you're just that. You're your genitals and that's it. And I think that argument is so problematic for many of those reasons why I've already said, right? Genitals are genitals, but what they mean is something different. Meaning is created. It's not inherent. It's not inherently born in the body. So we create our meaning. Meaning is, it's the definition of creating. And creation is not stable. It's not static. So what it means to have, to be a woman or to be a man, what those things mean, those will change over time and they change culturally. And we've already seen that. You know, we can look at plenty of historical documents over time to show that things have changed.
Yeah.
For example, we don't think a girl is a woman at the age of 12 and can get married anymore.
Right.
Not here.
Right.
Not in this state, at least.
There are states, though.
Yeah. God, scary. But, so I just feel like, you know, that is kind of a maybe too pat, too quick, too easy of a summary of that idea of the grotesque mother. But I feel like it's just really important to say every time that I think these ideas, they're only good insofar as we can apply them equally to ourselves as we can apply them to anybody else.
Yeah. And this is a conversation, you know, I mean, you and I have talked about having it on Filter, you know, since pretty much the beginning of Filter, close to.
Right.
And it's a difficult one for me because, you know, I have friends who are, you know, male to female trans folks who, you know, I've watched them struggle and the many, many struggles that come from that transition. I've had female friends who have been, you know, resistant to that idea. Not to say like I'm, it's about, you know, not picking sides, but it's interesting for me as a man to say, like, I don't want to invalidate anybody's experience of the world. I want to hear it out and, you know, maybe have an opinion on it at some point. But the conversation to me always seems so interesting because, it is so interesting because I almost never hear any kind of negative rhetoric towards female to male trans folks. Mm-hmm. It is almost entirely for male to female trans folks. We acknowledge that both exist and men. I mean, I know there are men complaining. I know there's lots and lots of men complaining about, you know, women becoming men, but at the same time, where the arguments are different and more, I don't know if opaque is the right word here. It's cloudy. The cloudy arguments, you know, where they're coming from places that seem like, or at least disguised as compassion, or maybe are misguidedly compassionate, you know, are from women, who, you know, take the title of feminist, saying that it is a way for men to grasp hold of the power of being a woman, now that being a woman is something that is afforded more power than it was in previous gender hierarchies.
Yeah, I mean, I never buy that argument because I think transgendered people, whether male to female or female to male, they are not afforded any power in our society. So I never really buy that argument. And I don't really buy the argument that women have come so far. I feel like we're still really struggling pretty gravely and deeply with some real inequities in our system. I think that there's a lot to be said about the fact that how can I put this in a way that's delicate? I can have a lot of compassion for people who have experienced trauma and are dealing with their trauma with rhetoric that I feel like is not only problematic, but it's damaging and hurtful. I can have a lot of compassion for that, for them, and we all can, and we can still say those ideas are wrong, you know, and those ideas are wrong for multiple reasons. When you say, like, I've heard a lot of these arguments now, unfortunately, I've had to do a lot of research on it. And when you say that, basically there are these clear sexual lines between male and female, you have to say that with a level of cynicism that I think is grotesque. I mean, like, you have to go to a point in your disavowal of knowledge, because the only way you can do that is to say, well, there is a lot of scientific data that shows that those boundaries between female and male, even in just corporal body terms, are not clear. But that's all just abnormal. Those data points don't support my conclusion, and so I'm going to put them over here in a box called abnormal, and I'm only going to deal with the data that supports my conclusion. Right?
Yeah.
So that's one issue. And then we have this other issue, which is that linguistically, we're not even talking about the same thing. Like, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Female bodies, male bodies, doesn't matter. They have no inherent meaning. And so we're really having a linguistic conversation about whether or not being a woman means having certain physical qualities, and those qualities are very particular, or being a man has certain physical qualities, and those qualities are very particular, right?
Yeah.
And that when we are grappling with that question, we are grappling with what it means to have those very particular physical qualities. And once you are having a conversation about what something means, you have entered into a different conversation. It's linguistic. It is subjective. It is cultural. It changes. It is not static. It is fluid in itself.
Well,
which makes it all the more symbolic and powerful for us to, I think, readily accept people who are challenging these very static, conventional. I mean, I think it's freeing to empower people to challenge it more and more and more, and cause more and more and more doubt upon what it even means to be a woman, what it means to be a man. And really give ourselves over to the power of the fact that maybe these things aren't as clear and aren't as binary as we choose to make them. What is?
Well, you're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM. It's the top of the hour. We've been talking to George Marie. And George, we're going to have to bookmark it, but I feel like we're opening up these issues, and I want to keep having this discussion. I mean, maybe we could even just make this a three-parter. I mean, it could be like a 10-parter, but let's see when we can do this again, hopefully soon, maybe next week. And as always, really appreciate your time. If you have time, if you have time to talk, I have time to talk. I feel like we covered a lot of ground today, but we can just, like I say, we'll jump right in with something, but we always talk. You gotta prepare to sing, basically, like Nina Simone. So
that's right. Except there will definitely not be singing, and my friends will really appreciate the fact that I'm coming out and saying right now I will not sing to you all.
Me too.
You don't want to hear
too,
it,
George. Yep. Well, go
I
sing to yourself.
You so much, Paul.
Yes. No.